Accession number 27308, Reel 2.
Ronald Walsh, Reel 2.
Yeah.
So you just returned, you just enlisted back in the Navy. Did you have to sign on with any terms and conditions at that point?
Let me see. A bit complicated hereafter, but let's take it from the start. I was sent to Waldfar in Sheerness. Now, this was not so much a barracks, it was just rooms on the dock side that were used, obviously, for short service engagements. Now, short service was different from the 12-year. It was 7 years with the Navy and 5 with the Reserve. So I was in short service at Sheerness Dockyard. Well, we did the old usual, a bit of training, then not long there, and then to... I went to HMS Iron Duke, the battleship from World War I, which was secured alongside South Road Jetty in Portsmouth. We used to do the old usual out to sea, 13.5-inch guns, very big guns. We used to go out around Abtera, the other side, and do a couple of shoots, you know, all that stuff. And a very vigorous boys' routine. We had about 20 or 30 boys on there, separate from the ship's company, boys' mess deck, and pre-war. Old Navy, to my mind, very strict. And, I mean, our day started before the others at 6:30 in the morning. The instructor would come down in the mess deck, bang, 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 with a stick. 7 minutes to get on the jetty with your hammock rolled up and the correct number of turns on the hammock. 7 turns on it. If you had 6, you had to account for it. But that was summer, winter. You fell in on the jetty, at South Railway jetty, with your hammock all neatly. When they'd inspect your hammock, go back and stow it in the hammock nettings. Stow it in the hammock nettings, fall in on the jetty within 5 minutes. So you fell in on the jetty, double all round the dockyard with a PTI, a physical training instructor, doubled you all round the dockyard. Quite a long run. Every day, rain, sunshine, snow, ice, doesn't matter what, you did that. Back you came to the ship, roll your trousers up to your knees, no socks or shoes, on the upper deck, rig the hoses. That means connect up the hoses all ready for the ship's company when they got up, would switch on and wash decks. And then get back down, and then we went to breakfast, and the others turned too. After breakfast, seamanship again, instructions all day. And that was it. That was the Iron Duke boys' training.
How was your mess organised, the boys' mess? Who would be in charge of you?
Oh, you had in charge, acting petty officers. That's petty officers in the Navy rig before they go into the other, peak caps and that. But they were acting petty officers. You did acting PO for 9 months. And after that, if you were okay, you'd get rated up petty officer. And we had a couple of them, and they were our instructors. Pretty strict. And that was it. And then, I suppose, in 1937, I was on there, and about 6 of us were drafted to the Glasgow, HMS Glasgow. Now, that was a ship. It was a beautiful ship. Brand new city-class cruiser. Beautiful ships. There were a lot of them. Manchester, a lot of them got sunk, or some of them, I don't know. Anyway, the Glasgow was a lovely ship. And
was you drafted as a boy seaman?
Yeah, I went to her as a boy seaman. I was still an ordinary seaman, still a boy seaman. After about, I joined her early 37. Well, when she commissioned, you know, we commissioned her. And we did all the usual running ups and all that lot, you know. I was an ordinary seaman. My job on there was captain's runner. We had a four-ring captain on there, and I was his runner. In other words, his messenger, where he went. When we were at sea, that is, I was close behind, so that if he wanted anything or a message run, I got it, you know, where you go.
How did you find your way around the ship?
Well, you had to get to know it. It didn't take you long to get to know a ship from bottom to top. And this particular time, it was better than, obviously, than the old Iron Duke. It was better than that. It was good, actually. I got settled into it, and we went on fine. Things happened. I know funny things happened. We had a beautiful ship, and at one time we were doing exercises in Weymouth Bay. And I was up beside the captain on the bridge with the other bridge personnel, and I don't know what happened to this day, but it seemed to me there was some sort of disagreement, I would think. I don't know. But all of a sudden, we were heading towards Weymouth Beach, about half a mile away, quarter of a mile. And then no one seemed... there seemed to be... I don't know. Going back that far, I can't remember what happened, but all I do know is the next thing, we were heading for Weymouth Beach. And then, bang, up on the beach, right up nearly to the road where the clock tower was. And we're up there, and there's holiday makers on the sands underneath, beside us, between the two piers. In those days, they had two piers. They've only got one now, but they had two. And we were up there amongst the sunbathers, and our stern sticking in the water still. Well, then it was all hands to the quarter deck, jump up and down, and engines going. It didn't work. We had aircraft overhead taking pictures. Two tugs were required from Portland came, and on about 4 o'clock on the odd tide, they pulled us off. Luckily, there wasn't any damage. We carried on. Well, this went on for a while. It was a good ship. Very good.
What do you think had happened when you ran aground?
Well, as I told you, I don't know. There was sort of... a captain passing order to one, a navigating officer passing orders somewhere else, orders going down below. I don't know, but all I do know is I watched her going to the beach and never sort of avoiding it, straight up on, bang. That boy, we did it. I mean, they can turn around and say, well, the steering went or something like that, and we couldn't do nothing about it. We still went up there at full belt. I don't know.
It must have been pretty embarrassing for the captain, that.
Well, I suppose it was, but then again, I wasn't very interested in him. I was interested in what was going on, and I know it was in the papers, the national papers the next day, a brand new cruiser up on the beach and all that, but anyway, that was just one incident.
How did you get on with the officers pre-war?
Well, you didn't, because pre-war, the officers were a separate branch. You never had any dealings with them. When you did, it was sir, and a big salute. The only ones you ever got near were chiefs and POs. Really, they were a different branch.
Did that change, just as a thing in your later naval career, did officers become less remote?
No, they came to the forefront. One particular one came to the forefront because we continued... We went to Jib, we did Jib of the Spanish War, stood up for that. We went to Stavanger in Norway. We had quite a good run. It was a lovely ship, a nice ship's company. And then we got back to, I would think, about the end of 1938. Anyway, we got back to Portsmouth, alongside South Railway Jetty. And by then, I was an ordinary seaman. And that meant that I was entitled for all-night leave. So I could have all-night leave, which was ideal, because Portsmouth, Livington, 45 miles, I could jump on the train if necessary. I did it for a couple of weekends, it was ideal. I had a couple of mates on there who weren't near, who didn't live near, and a bloke named Ollie Shepherd and Wacker Tombs, and we used to push off to Livington for weekends, you know, it was good. Oh, and then we had our duty weekends, whatever. And then one weekend I went home, and my dad said to me, "Your mum's not too happy." I managed to get a motorbike, and I did a couple of trips up and down on a motorbike. And then one weekend, my dad said, "Your mum's not happy with that motorbike." I said, "Oh, yeah. What are you going to do?" He said, "Well, when you go back to Pompey, if you can see a nice car, get it." He said, "And I'll pay for it." I said, "Oh, you can bet your boots." I said, "When I get back, I'll be looking for a nice car." So I came back to Pompey. I looked in the evening news, the Portsmouth Evening News in those days, and there was one there, a 1931 Austin 7 Ruby Saloon, excellent condition, £7.10. That was £7.10. And I thought, that looks nice. I went to the address in North End, knocked the door, and this middle-aged bloke came out. He said, "Oh, yeah, it's in the garage." He opened the garage doors. There was this car covered in a big white sheet, pulled it back, gleaming. He'd polished it every day. It was lovely. And he said, "Well, what do you think of that?" I said, "Oh, I think it's lovely." I said, "The only snag is, I ain't got any money." I said, "My dad's buying it for me." "Oh," he said, "where do you live then?" I said, "Well, I lived at Lymington in the New Forest." "Oh, I know it," he said, "jump in." And off we went to the New Forest and pulled up at my house, and my dad came down, brought my elder brother with me, and he said to me, "Brother, go and try it." He said, "Take it away, give it a run." Brother came back, he says, "Excellent, Dad, excellent." So the old man said, "Right," he said, to the bloke who owned it, he said, "Here you are." He said, "My son here will take you to Brockener Station. Here's £5, or here's the £7.10, and another couple of quid for your train fare to Pompey." And I had a car, a little Austin 7 Ruby Saloon, which was fine. And then I left the car there. I went back with my mates, and then I put a request in to see the captain, to permission to keep the car in, you know. So I got up in front of this captain, and he looked at me. There was witness and officers all round. There was all the requestmen there, and now I'm sat there, and he says, "So you want to bring a car into the dockyard?" I said, "Yes, sir." "And who do you think you are then that wants your own transport rather than public transport? Even chiefs and petty officers ride their boats in, yet you want to bring a car in?" And I said, "Well, yes, sir, I do, because A, my father's bought it for me. B, it's a lot more convenient to get from Portsmouth to Lymington in my own car than it is to go waiting at the station, or and therefore I would like to keep the car in." And then there was a little discussion amongst them, and he said to me, the captain said, "Right, now listen, I cannot deny this request, but I can add a few things. First of all, if you come off adrift any time, having used this car, you can stand by when you get in front of me, because you will come straight to captain's defaulters." He said, "And the second one is, you will not put this car in the officer's car park. So you will have to find somewhere in the dockyard where you can leave it." He said, "And the third one is this. When you go ashore, Liberty men, you're filling on the jetty in four deep, and the Liberty men are marched to Unicorn, to the main gate, main dockyard gate, where they file through past the police." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, you will follow the Liberty men out in that car until you get outside." I said, "Oh, yes, sir." So I said, that was it. I had to find somewhere to put the car, which wouldn't have been a problem. I'd just poke it in any corner and hope for the best. And for two or three for two or three weekends. We went down, the three of us, had lovely time, you know, it was ideal. Except that being a young OD, I wasn't very clever, and I used to not come back Sunday night. I used to leave it till Monday morning through the New Forest, leave early. Anyway, one trip back, I had a puncture. Out we got, changed the wheel, put a bit, and I clued up 10 minutes adrift at the other end. The two with me were cased, were dismissed, carry on. I was captain's divorce. And the next day, I got up there, and he said, I was waiting for this. 14 days number nines, no problem, I'd do that. And 14 days number nine meant falling all several musters, men under punishment during the day, no leave, and that was it. I thought, fair enough. And everything went fine for a few days, and then all of a sudden, we got the old buzz that the Glasgow would be escorting the King and Queen to Canada on a tour. And I thought, I'm under punishment. My car's poked in that little corner. And if we're going to be away for a couple of months, I'm in a fix because I can't leave it there unattended. So I've got to get it home. So I put a request in to have 4 hours leave on Saturday afternoon. So I got up in front of the captain and he says, right, now what's this? I said, well, it says I'd like 4 hours leave to take my car home. Oh, well. He said, you're under punishment. I said, yeah, I know, sir. I said, but I've also got a problem with the car. I've got to get it home. Ah, well, he said, this is the things you didn't think of, did you? He said, so, not granted. So I then went down the mess deck and I said to my two mates, well, what do you think of this then? What do I do with that? I'm men under punishment. I said, we'll have a little get together. I said, we'll discuss this. I said, and I'll get an answer. So we got round, we discussed it. And we decided, or I decided, that I would desert the Navy out of him. I'd get the bloody car home, no way. So I said, right, now, Ollie Shepherd, that is, in Wackatoons, I said, now, the last punishment, men under punishment, is 9 o'clock at night. The last liberty man is 9 o'clock at night. And I said, I'm in men under punishment. I said, now, to get ashore, we go from the hangar deck. We had two aircraft on board. From the hangar deck, you go down the gangway onto the jetty, past a Royal Marine sentry. And then at the bottom, you fall in four deep, and then you're marched out by a leading seaman out the gate. I said, no, this is what we'll do. 9 o'clock, I will muster with men under punishment. I said, as soon as I've done that, I'll nip up on the boat deck where Ollie will be waiting, or Wackatoons will be waiting with me collar, because Liberty men had to wear a Navy collar ashore. If you, after 4 o'clock, you, if you were on board, you took your collar off, and they were night clothing. So I had to get a collar on. Wacker was waiting with a collar and my overcoat. So he slipped my collar on and pushed it down the back. I slipped my overcoat on and I was ready for shore leave. I said, I waited beside a ventilator at the top of the ladder where the Liberty men would come up single file after being inspected by the officer watch down below. So I said, I waited there. In the meantime, Ollie Shepherd had gone ashore on the first boat, first Liberty boat, at 4 o'clock, and I'd given him my keys. He'd driven the car out the main gate and put it in Queen Street, and then he'd come back and give me the keys of my car. I said, so I waits there. Liberty men's inspected. First rank comes up there to the hangar deck, and I'm waiting behind the bed. I jumps in behind the last one of the first rank, so I'm in the middle. Over the brow, fall in on the jetty, I make sure I'm well up the front. 4D, march out the gate. I gets out. I've got my key. I jumps in my car and I drives down to Lymington. My brother's got a cycle and a motorcycle shop there, and I said to him, here's a car, give me a bike. We exchanged a bike for a car, and I jumped on my bike and rode all night up to Wincanton in Somerset. Now, I knew in Wincanton that my brother, another brother, who was worked for Petters, the oil engines, was working temporary near Wincanton while his firm moved up north. When he was ready, he was going up there. He had to get rid of it. So he had a little cottage, and he also worked on a farm temporarily until he could go back up. So I went straight to him, and I told him, I said, I've pushed off, I'm now a civilian. He said, right, he said, you've got a bike, you've biked all the way. I said, yeah, I've. He said, right, we'll have to get you a job then. He said, no, I'm on a farm temporary, and I'll take you over tomorrow and meet the boss. Well, it was pre-war, the old boss with the great big cigars, walking stick and breeches and all that, and he sat in his lounge, and he said, right, he said, you want a job on the farm? I said, well, yeah. He said, he said, do you know anything about him? I said, no, but I'm a willing learner. He said, oh. He said, well, what you done before? So I was in the Navy. He said, in the Navy? Well, what you doing out now? Oh, I said, medically discharged. He said, oh, all right. Oh, well, but right, he said, so he said, mainly it's the milking. He said, yeah. I said, well, I never tried it. I said, but my brother's, he'll give me. Right, he said, okay, you've got a job. I'll get you cards and I'll get you some cards and all that. And you're on. He says, see how it goes. He said, so I had quite a couple of weeks on the farm, 2 or 3 weeks on the farm. But I could never get used to the milking, which was the main thing. Every time I got under them, they didn't like it. I pulled the wrong one or something and I clued up in the muck in the gully. And I didn't like that at all. And I said to my brother one night, I said, I've got to get something else. I can't get hanging that milk in. So I looked through the papers, and there was a job going in Yeovil in Somerset, about 12 mile away, 9 or 12 mile away. It was for a driver, salesman, slaughterman, or what have you, that you did a lot in those days. So I applied, and I got an interview, and I went up to Yeovil. And there was a big businessman there named Ben Denon. He was the mayor of Yeovil. He had a big farm, a country farm. He had a shop in Princes Street, cook meat shop in Princes Street, the main street in Station Street. He had a big shop, behind which was a slaughterhouse. And I said, Monday mornings we used to... Oh, and he had 8 Austin vans, the bigger ones. And of course, I was able to drive them because I had a license. So the Monday mornings, it would be off to the market. It was only about 400 or 500 yards away. The old boy, the mayor, would go there with his big cigar. And he'd buy 15 steers, 10 pigs, lambs, and sheep, and we'd drive them all up to the slaughterhouse, pen them up. And that was Monday morning. By Wednesday night, they were all slaughtered and hung up in the fridges behind the main shop. All that lot done. And but the snag was, I lived 9 or 12 mile away, I don't know, but I used to push bike it in the morning and push bike home at night. So that meant I got up at 6 and I was biking until to get started at 7:30. And then we were working like blazes all day in the butchery, slaughtering and delivering. And I used to leave there about 7, get home in the dark, 7:30. So it was go to work in the dark, get home in the dark. But I was getting paid a massive amount compared with what I was. I was doing well financially. I did that, I suppose, for quite a few weeks. It was good, slaughtering, delivering, even Thursday and Friday, we used to go out in the country, or I did. We'd have a van, and I'd have a Thursday and Friday round, out in the country, round the wives, you know, and they'd see me pull up, they'd come to the back of the van, "What you got today then, butcher?" And you open it up, say, "Oh, lovely chipolatas there, oh yeah, pork sausage, I have a couple of pound of pork sausages, oh yeah, sharpen up the old knife, you know, on the old steel, and cut off a nice bit of pork, or whatever for them." And it was quite interesting, and I stuck that quite way through, until I thought, well, I've got to do something now. I got myself digs in Yeovil, which meant cut out all the riding, which was nice. And then I saw an advert for just around the corner in from Station Street. There was a big chemist's carpet shop, and they wanted a van driver. I went round and got that job. It was good. It was just day delivery, carpets and stuff. Oh, totally different. No slaughtering, no nothing. It was a lovely job. And I had digs. And then it was, by then it was 1940. And I went home. I was in these digs.
The war had actually broken out by
then. Oh, yeah, 39, September 39. I was still out there, and I had a good job in the butchery. And then I got this other job, and I went home. I was home one day, and people were getting call-ups. And I thought to myself, right, now, when I'm 20, which was March the 5th, 1940, when I'm 20, I've got to register. And then I've got to be able to account for my employers, and that I've got to do something when I'm 20, because I've got to register for service. So I thought, right, I'll register. I don't want to dodge the law. At first I did have a bright idea that there was always the buzz that the war was only going to last 6 months, and I thought, well, I'm laughing here. I've got a good job, well paid. And I've been assured that it'd be waiting for me. So I think I'll go in the army and do my whack for the war, and then come out and carry on. So I applied for the army. Well, I applied to the recruiting place, and I had to go to the Taunton to see an army captain who was sat there at a desk. And I gets up in front of him. He said, "Right, what you doing then?" I said, "I'm working for a butcher. I'm driver, salesman, all the lot." "Oh, you've got a license?" "Oh, yeah." I said, "Also for motorbikes." I said, "So what I'd like to do," I said, "is get into the RAC, Royal Army Service Corps." "Oh, yeah," he says. "Yeah," he said, "you've got a license?" "Yeah." "Oh, fine. I'll recommend you for the RAC then, and you can go away now and wait for a call-ups, you know." So I goes home. I goes back to my digs, and eventually I go to the landlady and say, "Oh, look at that buff envelope up there." So I opened it up, and there was a 5-bob postal order inside, and orders to... a railway ticket to Liverpool. And then it said I was to go to Liverpool and report to the Queen's Light Infantry. And I thought, well, the Queen's Light Infantry is not exactly the RASC. So I thought, I'm not too happy about trudging around the world when I can sail around it. So I thought, well, I gave it a bit of thought until the day came I had to go. And I looked at this railway ticket, and I looked at the other, and I thought, well, I can sort this one out. I can go back to the Navy and sort it out, carry on, and that's it. Or I can go in footslog. I thought, well, I ain't in a footslog. So I got a train ticket to Pompey. I came back to Portsmouth. And I went down Queen Street, and there was a big crowd around barracks, you know, watching all the bloody marching. And I watched it. I shouldered my way up to the gate, and there was a regulating petty officer on there, wasn't there? And I got up there, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I want to get in there." He said, "Well, you ain't going to get in here." He said, "No civilians in here, you know." I said, "Oh." He said, "No," he said, "you can't get in here." push off that sort of thing. So I went down Queen Street and to a cafe, and I sat in there with a coffee, and I thought, well, do I have another go, or will I go on the train up to Liverpool? So I thought, I'll have another go. So I went back, and I shuffled my way up the front, and this RPO said, I told you before, no civilians in here. I said, well, as a matter of fact, I'm not a civilian, I'm a matlow. He said, what do you mean you're a matlow? I said, what I said. He said, well, where's your uniform? Oh, I said, I scrapped that ages ago. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, if you want it straight, I'm a deserter, and I've scrapped my uniform, and about 14 months ago, I pushed off. Oh, Christ, he said, hang on there, don't move, and blew his whistle, overcome the guard with one each side, marched into recess and poked in there. I'm back in. And then it was 3 weeks of what they're going to do with you. I was in the recess.